first don't know me, is Tony Smith from the great class of 79. Which is well represented here. And I'm going to talk about democracy, and it's maybe a sign of the times that this is the third talk today with democracy in the title. Or one of them was democratic, as in party, but still. It's, I think, maybe a trailing indicator of concern. And before I do, I just wanted to remember one of our classmates, Owen Kupferschmidt. And I want to mention him because he was my first year, one of my first year roommates. He ran, I didn't keep up with him after graduation, but he went into, in a way, the same business as me, because he was running a development organization, or he was in a development organization dealing with debt relief. And our other roommate was Ezekiel Emanuel, who has had a very influential and important career in public health, and kind of in the same field of public service and supporting people. And I guess that some of their knowledge and care and nurturing for people must have rubbed off a little bit on me, and I ended up in a career which was also international and public service. So I just wanted to remember Owen in particular today. So in this session, I'll tell you what I wanted to get out of it. You can shout if you want something else. But what I wanted to get out of it was to share a bit of information about the kind of stuff that I do, and to use you guys as a way of ground-truthing some of my instincts and my hopes and concerns, just testing whether what I'm going to say you feel the same, or you think I'm way off beam and I ought to change careers and do something else. So that's what I want to get out of it. And I'm going to do this, give you a little brief history of democracy support. When I say brief, I do mean brief. Tell you what we do. And when I say we, the logo in the top, that's my organization, Westminster Foundation for Democracy. It's not a philanthropic foundation. We don't have a billionaire funding it. It's a government agency. I'm no longer in the government, but that agency belongs to the British government and funds it. And some other people fund it as well, but it's that type of foundation, not a Gates or other type of foundation. So what we do, why we do it, some current challenges. And I'm going to tell you at the end what I think, my conclusions, and then I'd like to hear what you think as well. And I'm speaking in this mostly about developing countries. We do not, as a foundation, work in the UK or the US or other mature democracies, as they used to be called. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And this is the first time in my career that I have ever put a picture of Ronald Reagan in a presentation. And I've done it. And by the way, I did this presentation. Jet lag helped because I was up very early this morning. Ronald Reagan made a speech. You can sort of tell that's in England. He made a speech in the Parliament in London, which led to the start of the democracy support industry in a way. In it, he said that he intended to get the US to do things to support, foster the infrastructure of democracy. He talked about free press, unions, parties. He talked about unions, universities, to allow people to develop their own culture, to reconcile their own differences. This was June 1982. It was Cold War. The speech was co-written by a American Foreign Service staffer called Mark Palmer, who had been posted in the USSR. He became ambassador to Hungary later. He had a lot of direct experience of working behind the Iron Curtain, and he was very active in thinking of ways that the US in particular could support the people who were suffering under those systems. And that speech led to the establishment of some U.S. organizations, the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, and the National Democratic Institute. Does anybody shout if they've ever heard of any of those? Great. 1%. They are very important organizations. They're world leaders in what they do. They have a very significant support in Congress. They've been part of the community that has pushed back against the current administration's attempts to really curtail U.S. efforts to support democratic freedoms in the world, both directly but through a sort of intellectual network of people who work on and think about these issues. So they're worth knowing about. 10 years later, so a bit less than 10 years later, this happened, fall of the Berlin Wall. 10 years later, in my country, the UK, a decision was taken to do something similar to what had happened here, to set up an organization to assist, support, and encourage peaceful establishment and development of pluralistic democratic practices and political institutions. That is taken from the Memorandum of Association which created the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. And there was a little explosion around that time of organizations with a D in the acronym, D for Democracy, Westminster Foundation. There's a Danish one, so it's Danish Institute for Parties and Democracy, a Netherlands one, Taiwan, Ideas, an international one in Stockholm, Demo Finland, you know where that is. So it was a bit of catch-up. There was actually some work in this area done previously. The Germans have a system of political foundations that were started after the war. They're broadly aligned with political parties, and they do political education work inside Germany. The aim of those organizations was to try and ensure that the public were well-educated about the importance of political engagement and the risks of totalitarianism, thinking about their own history, but they have a big international presence as well. And even before the Ronald Reagan speech, they were active, particularly in Latin America, when they were working on supporting democratic freedoms there. So what do we do? So this is my organization, but it's similar to what all those other organizations do. Each one is a bit different, but they're in the same sort of territory. We work in our programs with four main actors in countries, political parties, parliaments, electoral bodies, and civil society. Civil society, not in general, but in the way that it interacts with the political system, how parliaments, legislatures are able to be open to civil society, to NGOs, to advocacy groups, talking to legislators about their concerns, acting as a channel of communication for citizens. We work on a range of issues. We're broadly working on the quality of the political systems in those countries, but we focus a lot on representation and inclusion. So who are the political parties and the parliaments, legislators, who are they representing? Do they represent all elements of society or groups in it? Do they think in many countries where there are isolated, disadvantaged groups, so they think about them, which might be on the basis of ethnicity, they might be on the basis of sexual preference, on if they're persons with disability, etc. So inclusion's a main issue, and it's kind of overarching that. Not an excluded group per se, because they are half of the population, but the ability of women to participate equally in the political system is critical. Oversight and transparency, that's kind of what it means. So how do different elements in the political system hold the executive to account? And how open are the political systems in different countries, because transparency is an absolutely critical way for people to understand how power is being exercised. And then legislation and policy, you know, what are the issues that people are dealing with and how well are they doing that? We have offices in 30 countries, that many staff, that much money. And we do it, I'll say what we don't do. We don't go and say, we have a fantastic democracy in the UK, you need to copy it. That's obviously not a wise thing to do. But we find that people are most responsive when they are talking to peers. So peer-to-peer learning is a key element. So legislators like to talk to other legislators. Parliamentary staff like to talk to their counterparts, civil society similarly. Often there's a combination of those, but they like to feel that they're involved in a masterclass, sharing really strong practice, not somebody, 25-year-old, all respect to 25-year-olds, but telling somebody who's been in Parliament for 20 years, this is how you ought to be behaving. So we work on their systems, not ours. A few examples. You can shout if you know what these flags, which countries these flags are from. That's a tough one. Myanmar, Burma. So very quickly, just to give a bit of sort of flavor to what we do. Burma, you guys probably broadly know the history of there being a military dictatorship since independence, virtually. They've had sort of 80% of the time since independence under military dictatorship. Aung San Suu Kyi was able to compete fairly in elections for the first time in 2015. And there was great hope that a democratic transition had started. Although the constitution there reserves 25% of the seats in parliament, both the National Union Parliament and all of the state parliaments, to the military. So it is not a civilian constitution, it is not a democracy, but it is, we hope, on its way to it. We work with the National Union level parliament on absolutely basic issues, skills, their human resources department, helping their committees understand what it is they're meant to do. They didn't really know what they were meant to do. The idea of questioning their leaders was something completely new. Working on the way that they coordinate the timetable. They virtually have no time. You never know what's happening on any particular day in Parliament. Producing parliamentary records, just the basics. And we're one of many organizations that are working. Yes.
Good job there.
Yeah, we're doing great. Venezuela, we started working there after the elections in 2015, which led to the National Assembly being legitimately elected, the only legitimately elected part or legitimately established part of the entire state, virtually, in Venezuela. Who have been completely under attack since that election and virtually don't function anymore. But we've stayed there because we feel it's an important investment for the time when, and there must be a time when this will be true, when that bit of the political system has to start operating again. You have to have a National Assembly that does its job at some point. When that will be, none of us know, but for as long as we can, we are staying there to try and help to build skills and maintain morale, really. It's a tricky one because they've changed their flag recently, but this is Bosnia. So we work across all of the Balkan states, but Bosnia is one example where the political system and the constitution that was agreed with a lot of support from the US in the Dayton Peace Agreement in the 90s, and I was actually in the UK Foreign Service at the time working on that. That's part of the problem. It sort of locked in a lot of ethnic divisions in Bosnia, and the political system's in pretty bad shape, and there's been hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars spent on trying to improve it over the last 25 years, and not much progress made. We are now trying to not ignore the political system, but look at the people who need to have a stake in it, particularly women. So trying to get better representation for women. And the media coverage of women who campaign in elections is pretty terrible. A lot of aggression happens in other countries as well, but it's very, very prevalent there. And the last one, Morocco. I thought I'd throw in a pretty stable country. Morocco came out pretty well out of the Arab Spring, has a new constitution, and we have worked very closely with the Moroccan parliament to help it develop a strategy for what it should be doing under the new constitution, which provided new powers for the parliament, but didn't say very much about how to prioritize those powers and how actually to exercise them. So it's been a very close relationship. We have our office inside parliament and work very closely with them. So just some examples of what we do. I think the last thing I'd say on this is that the question we always have in mind is, how does change happen in countries? I think our broad view is that, first of all, improvement in democratic systems is not inevitable. If there isn't energy and leadership, it doesn't happen. And the evidence is, even when the economy grows, when countries become richer, it is not inevitable that democratic practice improves. The evidence is that actually the economy tends to be captured as it grows, and power is exercised by a relatively small number of people. Secondly, thing we think is that change generally happens through a combination of factors. Some of it is very patient, long-term work. You know, can you get your legislature just to do the things it's meant to do properly? Can you get your judicial system to operate more effectively? So you have to invest patiently in that long-term capacity. And then you have to have leadership. And the leadership is really important when there's an opportunity, when something happens that provides some energy that can disrupt things. That can be an election, any election. It could be a war. Could be an economic crisis, all sorts of things. And you cannot predict when that's going to happen. But if you've invested in leadership, and leadership not just the president, but the person at a middle level in the judiciary or the financial regulatory body or the parliament, who knows that their role is to act in an objective, non-partisan way, then you've got a better chance of it leading to significant change. And the last thing I think we believe is that outsiders cannot provide that leadership. Leadership has to be there in the country, but you can support it and nurture it if it's there from the outside. Why do we do this? So one answer to why we do this, and an answer that's often given, is because it's good for us. It's good for us because it will solve problems. So just two examples. That's meant to be a picture depicting poverty. So will democracy get rid of poverty that make a country richer? Will it end war? Will it provide stability and security? I wish it were always true that that would happen, but it's not. And there are counterexamples. So when our organization was started in 1992, post-Soviet Union, if you said you were in favor of democracy, you didn't have to explain anything. It was completely obvious that it was the better system in the world. You looked over the wall from East Berlin to West Berlin, and you saw what the difference was between communist system and a free capitalist system, and the same was true in some other parts of the world. Now there are counterexamples. China, which has been supporting incredible economic growth and improvement in the conditions for a huge population for a long time, Rwanda, Kazakhstan, just a few examples. So there are counter models around which people follow. And if we argue only that we support democracy because it delivers these benefits, then we're going to be seen as unreliable and dishonest in our reasoning. So for me at least, or for our organization, this is why we support democracy. Because it's a human right, because we believe that democracy is a set of values, that we're all of equal value, that we have to work together to prevent the abuse of power, and democracy is the best way of doing that. And that democracy is itself a way for countries to develop and progress and improve, and for societies to progress and improve. We think that the correlation is actually pretty strong between open democratic systems and systems which have greater levels of prosperity and less instability. And there are statistics around that. I don't have them with me, but they do exist. And Amartya Sen, we have a few quotes in the front of our strategy, and one is by Amartya Sen, a famous Indian economist. A country does not have to be deemed fit for democracy, rather it has to become fit through democracy. So there's been a lot of argument that you have to get stability and economic growth first and then worry about the system of government. And like Amartya Sen, we believe that that's wrong, that democracy is the way in which you protect individuals, demonstrate that you believe all people have equal value, and enable development to take place in a country. So, getting towards the end, there are obviously a lot of challenges to democracy at the moment. So it's hard to know where to start with this. I've just picked out a few. The first one is just to kind of understand what's going on. You know, where are we? And that depends, your answer to that depends a lot on your perspective, the time frame that you choose. So there is no doubt that in terms of the overall level of democratic freedoms in the world, we're a lot better off now than we were 100 years ago, a lot better off than we were at the end of the Second World War. But it's also true that we are living in a period in which there's been a decade, maybe a bit more, of democratic recession, as it has been called, I think, by Francis Fukuyama. So I don't really know whether this is just a blip and we'll get back to a trajectory which is more positive, or whether this is a really long-term change. So the one challenge is just to assess how serious this is. At the democracy session in this room earlier today, there was a view that we were at a, what was the word used?
Inflection.
The most important point of inflection in human history, I think, was what was said, which was a combination of climate change and the decline in democratic freedoms. I think something else was thrown in as well, globalization and changes in the global economy. So it is possible that we are entering a period where the combination of challenges that we face mean that we've passed the high point of democratic freedom and it's going to be downhill for a while. But I don't know that, and I hope that's not true. That's not what I want to feel. The second challenge is democracy delivering? This again was picked up in that earlier session a bit, so, and relates to what I said a few minutes ago. If democracy is so good, what is it doing for us? I think it kind of depends on what you think it should be delivering. And I've said that a couple of minutes ago. Is it meant to be delivering prosperity and stability? Broadly, I think it does, but it's not guaranteed. I think the answer to me feels as though there is something significant that's happening. It is around that point made earlier about the end of the American dream. The American dream, obviously, is an American phenomenon. It was never completely true. The American dream has existed for a long time with a lot of inequality of access to power, a lot of effort to monopolize economic gains, and a lot of people excluded from it. But I think that the combination of that loss of confidence in the direction of travel, combined with the climate change challenge, maybe is something that we can work at to see whether actually the dream needs to change, and that's not just for America, but for a lot of other countries, including UK, so that people feel that democracy is enabling them to engage on issues which have been ignored for a while and treated unequally, but we'll see. Related to that, how does democracy feel to individuals? So a lot of people in my neighbourhood in London, who, if you say to them, you know, we've got this amazing democratic system, we've got fantastic rule of law, a great judicial system, we've got a parliament, okay, ignore Brexit for the moment, but generally does things seriously, they don't fight in the corridors, they do their work, we've got a government which in most circumstances is, you know, serious and professional, we're pretty uncorrupted. Isn't it great? A lot of people in my neighbourhood, and you can say about lots of neighbourhoods in any country, don't really feel that. You know, they don't feel that they have a voice, they don't feel that they are consulted, that it matters to them. And it is interesting, there is research which shows that over the past 10 years, globally, not in every single country, but the broad trend is that political power has been concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. There are exceptions to that, particularly the perennial stars of the top of the chart, the Scandinavians, are pretty egalitarian, but the rest of us have been living through a period when political power has measurably been concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. So it's not surprising that a lot of people feel that they don't really have access to power. Then the last one I threw up was just about democratic institutions. At the moment, say take the UK, the traditional political parties clearly are not adequately representing voters. That probably is true here as well. And in many countries it's the same, but the political parties that were created during or after the Industrial Revolution that represented sort of classes and types of production are outdated. They haven't really kept up. Parliaments, legislators, congresses still feel pretty 19th century. We actually write our laws on sheepskin still, and they are rolled up and kept in a room in Parliament. They have a wax seal on them. We do have we don't have a written constitution, so we can adapt to things relatively quickly, but still, you know, it's not Parliament is not a natural user of Twitter. So decision making feels pretty old-fashioned sometimes at the moment, and that I think is a big challenge. How are there ways, other creative ways in which it can be updated? So there are lots of other challenges, I'm sure, but those are the ones that came to my mind. Actually, there was one that came up in the earlier session also about identity politics and diversity and tribalism. One of the panelists said that we are naturally tribal. Identity politics clearly is a big challenge. Living in London, and I personally am not sure which tribe I should belong to. I think we can turn that around. I think that's an opportunity as well. I think inclusion and diversity is a real opportunity for democracies as well. So conclusions. Had to have Winston Churchill. Churchill famously said in a debate in Parliament that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. And I think that's still true. I think that it's true because it is essentially about, for me, the key job of democracies is to prevent the abuse of power by the executive. Power almost inevitably, when it's held in a small number of hands, those hands try to accumulate more power. It ends up being used unfairly. There are very, very few examples where that's not the case. It's also true that at the moment, we are seeing in many places in the world the autocrats, the tyrants' playbook being used repeatedly. There's some fantastic university in the world where all the tyrants are pooling all their knowledge and sharing it really effectively. It's probably an online course that you can do in that. A friend of mine, an academic in the UK, wrote a book last year called How to Rig an Election. It's in that one particular field of elections, a really great catalogue of the way in which normal democratic processes are distorted and manipulated by autocrats, you know, going from controlling the media for a year before the elections, making it very difficult for opposition parties to operate effectively. Rigging the vote itself is kind of passé, it's sort of the old way of doing things, but if necessary, you do that. You try and control things before that to make sure that you are the one that is going to win. So democracy has to be able to operate effectively to prevent that inevitable instinct that people will try to hang on to and misuse power. Okay, I'm going to, especially with Kurt here, I'm going to take a real risk because I'm going to put a picture of Aristotle up. And Aristotle, I cannot confess to have read when I was here, but I think probably a lot of you did. And I put him up because of two reasons. One is that this issue of how democratic systems can work effectively, combining mass involvement in legitimizing government without descending into either oligopoly, so masses of people being manipulated so that a few people behind the scenes take power, which is what Plato said would happen, and Aristotle was challenging that a bit. So how you can make a system work without descending either into oligopoly or into anarchy and then tyranny, because anarchy will lead to a strong man taking over. So that challenge has been around for more than 2,000 years. And Aristotle's answer was around education, effectively. He essentially said, admittedly talking about a relatively small percentage of the population that were citizens, but that if citizens were effectively engaged and able to understand better the debates and the challenges of government, then a more open and participatory system of government could be effective. So I think there was something in that. We can obviously make progress since Aristotle in developing it a bit. But our understanding of who is involved has to evolve. So Frederick Douglass helped abolish slavery. Emmeline Pankhurst, had fun on Google last night finding pictures for this. Women's suffrage, was 100 years ago last year that some women in the UK got the vote. New Zealand were the first, I think, 120 years ago, giving women the vote. This is the symbol of the Paralympics, so persons with disability, and we've actually, in our programs, have been working a lot with persons with disabilities in different countries, and it's an incredibly rewarding area of work for us. People of whatever their sexual preference. So a more comprehensive understanding of who it is that needs to be involved in politics is very important. So this challenge of working out how to enable the widest possible number of people in society to be part of the political system without them and the system being manipulated is a very old challenge. It was dealt with by the Levellers. I love the fact in Amherst there's a publisher's on the street up there called the Levellers Printing Press or something like that. 16th, 17th century group in England who were trying to ensure that people, including those fighting in the Civil War for Cromwell, actually had some political power at the end of it. Through John Locke and Jefferson and Madison and John Stuart Mill and present-day thinkers. That problem has been around for a long, long time. So, this is where I say what I think, and then I want to know what you think. So I think, first of all, the future is visible here and now. What I mean by that is the answers to these challenges already exist. Somewhere, there are people who are doing things which are addressing the ways in which the executive tries to manipulate power. There are people who are thinking about better ways of ensuring full representation in the political system and inclusion of all groups. There are people considering different ways of decision-making being done without relying entirely on a 19th century building and set of procedures to do that. We just have to find those and focus on them. Second, I think democracy is never secure, but has to be fought for every day. I think there is, the shorthand is used a lot when talking about democracy. The word democracy is just said and then not examined and considered more what is meant by it. And that includes my organization, my government, who say, well, you're either democratic or you're not. If you're not, we'll just wait for you to be democratic, then we'll do stuff with you, or we'll carry on trading or stopping migrants coming to our country from your country. Democracy doesn't work like that. We're all on a spectrum, and there are things that we can do in every country that are important in trying to strengthen good democratic practice. And finally, it's not an institution but a culture. I was glad again in that earlier session that somebody used the word culture. I think they're referring to a Daniel Moynihan quote in it. But in our work, what we often find with the partners in the other countries that we're working for is that they're interested not so much in the rule that we use, but in the culture that we've developed. Why is it that people in our parliament have all agreed that there are a set of rules that they will adhere to? They don't try and cheat those rules, generally. I think that's, that is true in our all four parliaments in the UK. People generally do not try to cheat. It's a little bit different here, actually. I was particularly struck by the, failure to even consider Obama's Supreme Court nomination. How can you just say, no, we're not going to do that? So I think the cultural, behavioral aspects are really important. Because no matter what rule you have, somebody can find a way to cheat. And you have to develop a set of expectations and beliefs and commitments in society. And our in the UK, thank God, our democracy does not depend entirely on who is the head of the Conservative and Labour Party and what those 650 people in our House of Commons are doing on any particular day. It's much broader and deeper than that. And it goes into the press, it goes into social groups, advocacy groups, it goes into local government, it goes into a whole range of people whose support and whose vigilance is needed to ensure that democracy is sustained. And that, if you talk about checks and balances, this is my sort of made-up formulation here, I think checks include transparency and the rule of law. Balance, I was not quite sure what balance is meant to refer to in the sort of classic political science definitions. I'm not a political scientist. But I do think that those issues, education, inclusion, and consent, are part of what is needed to balance the formal political powers that are used in any government. Quote Amherst, 2019. What do you think? So that's it. Thank you very much. So what do you think?
Tony, first of all, I want to thank you for agreeing to come here and do this. I know it's a longer schlep than many of us made, and I appreciated the threat. I don't know when you started sounding like Tony Blair. I don't remember you sounding like this in Amherst.
No, I didn't.
I guess I work as a union organizer and have become increasingly pessimistic about democracy, although I would never admit that to the workers I represent. And I guess I'm looking to you and to others here. When you see what's happening in this country, and when you see the kind of balkanization of countries, the nationalism that's succeeding in a lot of European countries, the rise of the right, it's very frightening and discouraging when it comes to democracy. And I don't see the Venezuela thing, if ever there's an example of what's not working out so well, I mean, there's an example. Why should we be even a little bit optimistic? What successes are you seeing that can help us leave here thinking, oh, okay, well, that's pretty good, yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for persuading me to do this, actually. And anybody else who has a good example, please shout it out. They're always needed. I mean, Venezuela, I'll start with. I mean, it's absolutely true that Venezuela is in a complete crisis. There is no respect for democratic practice there. But I think, you know, the fight back, in a way, has started. I mean, there is a reason why Hugo Chavez was elected all those years ago and why Nicolas Maduro has been able to maintain power. And the original reasons were about social injustice in Venezuela, very unequal society, a hugely rich country, a lot of very poor people throughout the 60s and 70s. The way in which that was used as an excuse to distort the political system was, you know, became a scandal, and led to a position where a legitimately elected National Assembly can now be overruled by an illegitimately elected constituent assembly, which basically does whatever it wants. But there's a much clearer realization among the people in Venezuela that things have gone catastrophically wrong and something has to change. So the reason it hasn't changed is essentially power, you know, military power with a lot of interests, you know, not to go into all of them, but there's a sort of network of people who have a vested economic and security interest in this Venezuela who are not letting that change happen. But I think that if change is going to happen, it's only going to work if the opposition recognize, because a lot of the opposition are not people that you would want in power, to be honest. And there has to be, I think there's greater recognition that Venezuela has to find a new set of policies and approaches that deal with the reasons why Chavez was elected all those years ago and how Venezuela reconciles that oil wealth with deprivation.
This is supposed to be the optimistic example. I'm getting more depressed.
No, well... Well, what do you think? Do you think there's I mean, one thing I know is there's no magic way of delivering short-term change in any country in the world. Here, my country, any country. You have to have building blocks, so that's what you've got to look for. I'll find some other examples, but there are more hands up, so I've got to move on.
So, Tony, that was great, all the presentation. I think about Turkey, and I think about this, because it's a relatively mature, long-standing democracy with a long tradition of appreciating democratic norms, and then it's sort of committed suicide, right? The people themselves voted in favor of constitutional amendments that gave Erdogan essentially dictatorial powers. Mm-hmm. And I wonder why in the world that happened. And I think, I love the fact that you emphasized education. But I think the education has to start at a very early age so that you teach kids, teach teenagers the way the institutions of power are supposed to work, so that as those people ultimately age into positions, some of them positions of some authority or power, you establish norms, a culture, respect the democratic institutions that allows people to be shocked. And just by way of comparison, what we're seeing in the United States today, I think, is a reflection of the fact that we don't teach civics anymore. Right? And so people are like, David Souter's got a great speech, it's on YouTube if you want to find it, in which he's saying, greatest threat to democracy, I said this earlier today, is the failure of civics education, because you get people who then can say, Ireland can fix it, you don't need that judiciary, you don't need the press, right? And he almost quoted Trump before Trump said, Ireland can fix it, he used those exact words. But I'm just wondering what your organization's focus is, if at all, on educating the people as opposed to educating the legislatures.
So we obviously cannot do everything. We're a relatively small organization. We've got a niche which we work in, but we know that that niche will only be useful to work in if others are doing things, including on rule of law, which we don't work on. Media freedom, we don't really work on that a bit, but not very much. And civic education. Civic education is hugely important, but it's, again, not something we work on, but it is something that's important. And I agree about a country like Turkey, although, you know, one UK politician talking about the importance of the rule of law said, you know, in embedding the rule of law in a country, it's the first 400 years that count. So, you know, these things can take a while. And Turkey has not been democratic for that long and has had some pretty undemocratic parties in it. And Erdogan has had to resort to, you know, underhanded things as well along the way, including the election in Istanbul the other day. So just going back to Ashley, the European Parliament elections, there was a real fear. The results came out on Sunday night, Monday. Real fear that extremist right-wing parties would do really well. They did a bit better, but actually the dominant change was towards parties that were very democratic and actually quite pro-European. The parties that lost were the traditional centre-right and centre-left. So I think there is a bit of a fight back. In the UK, the parties that were... There was a party called the Brexit Party, which was only founded 6 weeks ago, has no policies except for the one in its name, and doesn't say exactly what it means by that. Actually, it did well, but not much better than UKIP, the predecessor. And the parties that were in favour of remaining in the EU and working constructively actually won a bigger share of the vote. So, you know, societies do need to fight back. And how did that happen? You know, there are lots of people I know who have started sort of civic movements, who are part of groups who say, because we've been dealing with this for 3 years, you know, we've got to do something about it. So, and I hope there are people like that here as well. Yeah, one up there.
Thanks, Tony. It was a great, great presentation. I mean, you touched on this, but you know, there are a couple of economic and political models out there. China's one, Western democracy the other. We were joking about Brexit, but you know, Western democracy, if you're a country in Africa or a country choosing different paths and looking at the various models, I'm not sure Western democracy shows up very well against, say, the growth models of China and some of the others. You find yourself defending, not just answering the question, how do you improve democracy, but rather, you know, should you be choosing democracy over, you know, what China or some of the other arguably more successful economies are doing?
Yeah, this comes up a lot, and I always say yes, they should choose democracy, because actually if you ask people in that country, what would you prefer, to have somebody decide, take all the decisions for you and you have no voice and be subject to arbitrary exercise of power, or would you like to have a system which has at least a set of procedures and checks and balances that protect human rights and enable your voice to be heard? They generally choose the second. In fact, they virtually always choose the second, unless they're at war. Countries which are in conflict, people very definitely choose strong leadership, which sacrifices, at least temporarily, a lot of those freedoms. But having done that, they still have to do a good job at developing economic and social policies that work. There's no, you know, there's no getting around that. No matter whether you're a dictatorship or a democracy, to be successful economically, you have to be smart about your policies, all of your policies. So it's not a get out of jail free card. But there are also, you know, pretty credible arguments that open societies that enable competing voices and policies to be argued out are more successful. And in Asia, we did a thing last year, I can't remember all the details of it, but actually the majority of countries that were, a very high majority of countries that were doing well economically were also doing better in democratic freedoms as well. China is a massive outlier in virtually every way that you can think of. So it's not a model that, you know, most countries could follow, even if they wanted to. They can follow an autocratic playbook, and China is, you know, racing ahead of the world in systems of control of its population. That is something to worry about.
Thank you, Tony. I'd be curious to hear about what you think about Taiwan, because based on my very limited knowledge, it seems to be an example of a successful transition to democracy in a non-Western setting, and yet it's a bit of a bastard in the international community that other countries will not have relations with it because of a fear of offending China. Is it true that Taiwan is relatively successful, and do you think that it will stay that way, or is its isolation problematic?
It's isolation is very, well, yes, I think it is a success. I kind of have a soft spot for Taiwan because they have a Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, which they modeled on us. They came to see us and said, oh, we like that. They came to the National Endowment and the NRI and NDI and IRI as well. But they are a successful country economically, pretty obviously. They are successful democratically. They have a vibrant democracy. But it is under huge threat. And it's under threat partly because it is a successful democracy and it's an example of the fact that there isn't an Asian exception which says Asian people are not capable of exercising political power in a way that is like a liberal democracy, a democracy that respects individual rights and freedom. So it is under threat for, you know, the reasons we all know about, because it is claimed by China. Is that your whole question? I can't remember.
Yes, thank you very much.
And by the way, you guys can answer the questions too, if you want to.
I was intrigued to see political parties listed several times among the groups you work with, and George Washington famously recommended against them, and that didn't last very long. Mm. Do you view political parties as a downright good, or is it sort of an inevitable evil that's... Would you create? Do you recommend the creation of them if they don't already exist, or
Yes. In our systems of government, which are representative democracies, so where the legislature is in effect, has the exercise of power... there are countries which don't have political parties. There are quite a few that have gone backwards and forwards in Africa, in the Middle East. We were working in Bahrain until recently, and they've generally allowed political associations but not parties. In Uganda, they banned political parties for a long time and then let them back in. And in the periods where there weren't political parties, essentially they were just manipulated by the executive. Political parties can be manipulated as well, and they are. But, you know, in most, there is research. So there's a guy who, in a UK university, does research on this, whose findings are that countries that have not just political parties, but established political party systems, so a real mechanism for ensuring that political parties are part of the architecture, so some sort of regulatory framework, are more successful in their democratic practice. So they do better in terms of their legislative practice and alternation of power between different interests. So Yes, we have political parties on our board, so of course my boss is on the board, are people I respect. No, but I genuinely do think that in most cases you need them, but they are in trouble in most countries as well and need to adapt. Hi. Yep. That's you.
Yeah, me. Great. So I'm interested in experiments that are going on below the nation state level.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, I'm from the Pacific Northwest and involved in some stewardship issues that bleed into governance around salmon recovery. And matter of fact, I'm just involved in an experiment on the Columbia River Basin now that we are talking about some level of governance at a regional level, which was super state level, but not national level.
Yeah.
And it's informed also by Native American treaty rights, things like that. So there's some architecture in there of law, but it's actually kind of organic and emergent. And it's also been informed by great policy consensus center that was formed by William Ruckelhaus, you know, the first EPA administrator, the Ruckelhaus Policy Consensus Center. So I'm kind of interested, you know, about just, you know, looking at that level, there may be some patterns that kind of emerge out, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting idea. I don't have a huge amount of knowledge of that. We're not, as an organization, a think tank. We sort of have our resources to do the things we're doing and try to check that we're addressing where the real problems are. And what that resonates, the reason that resonates with me is that the issue of how political decision-making is managed in most countries is a big, big issue. I've said, you know, a few times, political parties don't seem to be able to represent the interests among citizens in the way that they used to. So there is a question, should you find a way of bypassing political parties, because citizens' assemblies are something that have been tried in a number of countries quite successfully. Get a group of citizens chosen at random but in a representative way and really give them all the information they need to debate an issue. And in a number of places, they've come up with a consensus about a way of addressing an issue which competing political parties have not been able to do, because it's not generally in their interest to reach consensus. And that consensus can then be taken to a decision-making forum, like a Congress or a referendum, and dealt with there. And I think at local level, you're more likely to find issues that are not on the national agenda that can be dealt with in that group. Switzerland, Dave and Cathy here. Switzerland came up in the previous, you missed it, there was a Swiss presentation. About the way that they do referendums. I guess part of what was described was the spectrum of issues that can be dealt with in a different way than the normal way, including some which are quite local in character, where you can have relationships and commitments that enable you to reach agreement that sometimes doesn't seem possible at other levels. So I think it is important.
So we'll just quick follow up on that is that this initiative that I was referring to was initiated in the Obama administration, but it has prevailed into the current administration. And I think it's because it has very conservative members from Idaho involved in participating in it. So it kind of gives, you know, it gives a cover for this administration, which is actually wants to undo everything that the Obama administration did.
Yeah. I know, Ashley, if you think that the field that you're in is also in need of some more imaginative ways of reaching consensus or tackling issues.
That's something we'll have to talk at our 45th reunion. Now, there's a whole presentation in there. Millions of things could be done differently, and I have no clear path towards better organizing, to be honest with you. And I'm mindful of the time as well. I just want to again thank you, Tony, for